Hello, this is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, February 26th. Let's begin with articles on the front page. We have a beautiful photograph of American white pelicans, which have begun their trek north a bit too soon, arriving in Decatur this week to find Lake Decatur covered with ice. This photo was taken Monday, February 24th, near the Lost Bridge Road boat launch, and the birds gathered along a spot free of ice, allowing them to swim around and gather food before the next leg of their migration. This week's spring-like temperatures should go a long way to ridding the lake of its ice covering. Now from Janelle Alicia, Associated Press. Banning junk food from SNAP, not easy. Past efforts show task would be complicated. A push to ban sugary drinks, candy, and more from the U.S. program that helps low-income families pay for nutritious food was tried before, but it may soon get a boost from new Trump administration officials. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the newly confirmed Health and Human Services Secretary, and Brooke Rollins, the new Agriculture Secretary, signaled they favor stripping such treats from SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Kennedy called for the government to stop allowing the nearly $113 billion program that serves about 42 million Americans to use benefits to pay for soda or processed foods. The one place that I would say we need to really change policy is in the SNAP program and food stamps and school lunches, is Kennedy told Fox News host Laura Ingraham last week. There, the federal government in many cases is paying for it, and we shouldn't be subsidizing people to eat poison. In one of her first interviews after being confirmed, Rollins said she looked forward to working with Kennedy on the issue. When a taxpayer is putting money into SNAP, are they okay with us using their tax dollars to feed really bad food and sugary drinks to children who perhaps need something more nutritious? Rollins said. These are all massive questions we're going to be asking and working on in the coming months and years. Yet, removing certain foods from SNAP, known for years as food stamps, isn't as simple as it sounds. The program is run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, not HHS, and is administered through individual states. It is authorized by the Federal Food and Nutrition Act of 2008, which says SNAP benefits can be used for any food or food product intended for human consumption, except alcohol, tobacco, and hot foods, including those prepared for immediate consumption. Excluding any foods would require Congress to change the law or for states to get waivers that would let them restrict purchases, said Katie Berg, a senior policy analyst for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research group. Over the past 20 years, lawmakers in several states proposed stopping SNAP from paying for bottled water, soda, chips, ice cream, decorated cakes, and luxury meats like steak. None of those requests have ever been approved under either Republican or Democratic presidents, Berg said. In the past, Agriculture Department officials rejected the waivers, saying in a 2007 paper that no clear standards exist to define foods as good or bad, or healthy or not healthy. In addition, the agency said restrictions would be difficult to implement, complicated, and costly. They also might not change recipients' food purchases or reduce conditions such as obesity. Anti-hunger advocates point to research that shows SNAP recipients are no more likely than other low-income Americans to buy sugary drinks or snack foods. They say limiting food choices undermines the autonomy and dignity of people who receive, on average, about $187 per month, or about 6.16 per day, according to latest figures. This is just another way to cut benefits, said Gina Plata Nino, a deputy director at the Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit advocacy group. It's like, how do we restrict people more? How do we stigmatize them more? Bills are pending in Congress and in several states to restrict SNAP benefits from paying for soda, candy, and other items. Representative Josh Brechin, an Oklahoma Republican, sponsored the Healthy SNAP Act. If someone wants to buy junk food on their own dime, that's up to them, he said. But what we're saying is don't ask the taxpayer to pay for it and then also expect the taxpayer to pick up the tab for the resulting health consequences. One SNAP recipient said she uses her monthly $291 benefit to buy necessities such as meat, oil, milk, and coffee. Martina Santos, 66, of New York City, supplements those foods with fresh vegetables and fruits from a pantry run by the West Side Campaign Against Hunger, where she's a volunteer. Because she has diabetes and other health conditions, she said she understands the importance of using the benefits only for nutritious options. For me, SNAP is to be used towards healthy food to get people to avoid all the disease they're having around right now. Obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, Santos said. In Kansas and elsewhere, bills that would ban soft drinks and candy highlight some of the challenges of such changes. Several pending bills seek to keep SNAP from paying for soft drinks, but they would continue to allow drinks containing milk, milk alternatives like soy or almond milk, or drinks with more than 50% vegetable or fruit juice. Candy is characterized as any unrefrigerated, flourless preparation of sugar, honey, or other natural or artificial sweeteners in combination with chocolate, fruits, nuts, or other ingredients or flavorings in the form of bars, drops, or pieces. By that definition, Kit Kat and Twix bars, which contain flour, wouldn't be banned. Juices that contain high amounts of sugar but are more than half fruit juice by volume also would be allowed. Such conundrums stymied changes to the SNAP program for decades. Now, though, the momentum behind Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again movement could spur a new focus on solutions to poor diets that account for leading risk factors for disease and early death. When we talk about the SNAP program, we have to remind people that the N stands for nutrition, said Dr. Anand Parekh, chief medical officer of the Washington, D.C. think tank of Bipartisan Policy Center. It's about time that both parties can come together and see what are the innovations here to improve diet quality and nutrition. Now from Brendan Moore and Rob Stroud, Springfield. Illinois, Jim Edgar, ex-governor hopeful in pancreatic cancer fight. Former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar revealed on Monday that he has been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, casting it as a significant challenge that he remained hopeful of overcoming. Edgar, 78, a moderate Republican who was raised in Coles County, served two terms as governor from 91 to 99. Before that, he was Illinois Secretary of State for a decade and was elected to two terms in the state legislature. He resigned midway through his second term to become an aide to Governor Jim Thompson. In retirement, Edgar has devoted much of his time to the Edgar Fellows Program, an annual five-day executive training designed by the former governor to influence attitudes and foster mutual understanding among emerging Illinois leaders across partisan, ethnic, and regional lines. Edgar revealed the diagnosis in an email to program alums. Doctors at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago have determined I have pancreatic cancer that has spread, Edgar wrote. They and physicians at Mayo Clinic are coordinating on a treatment regimen that I am following initially in Arizona, where we spend the winter, and later in Springfield when we return. We do not underestimate this challenge, but we have confidence in the medical team helping us address it. Edgar has had health issues in the past. He underwent an emergency quadruple bypass surgery in 94 and was hospitalized for chest pains in 98. In an interview with Lee Enterprises, Edgar said he planned to take every month or year that I can get and hopefully be able to enjoy life too. The key here is you try to draw out the life expectancy, Edgar said. It varies from person to person, but if you can get a couple more years or three more years, maybe in that time, they might find the silver bullet finally, which they haven't on this yet, apparently. Edgar said he was diagnosed shortly after the new year and has undergone three sets of chemotherapy. He said he's taking each day at a time, and at times difficult request for someone who has always been a planner. I'm trying to keep my mind off it as much as I can because it can be depressing if you think about it, Edgar said, acknowledging the historically grim statistics associated with the disease. Still, Edgar hopes that he'll be around for a while longer. We're going to keep chugging on, hopefully fight the good fight, get as much time as we can, and maybe get lucky and they find the silver bullet, he said, mentioning his hope to keep doing Edgar Fellows, becoming a great grandfather, and seeing his horses run a little faster than they've run in the past. So that's what kind of keeps me going, he said. During his tenure as Secretary of State, Edgar successfully fought for tougher drunk driving laws and spearheaded an effort to mandate drivers carry auto insurance. Edgar was narrowly elected governor in 1990, but was reelected with a massive margin in 94, winning all but one of the state's 102 counties. As governor, Edgar, boosted by a strong national economy, helped shepherd the state budget from a more than $1 billion deficit when he entered office to a more than $1 billion surplus when he left. He also signed into law what is now known as the Edgar Ramp, which laid out a 50-year schedule to get the state's underfunded pension systems to 90% funded by 2045. The state struggled and often did not make the payments called for under the ramp since it was implemented, however. He left politics with high approval ratings after his second term, rebuffing calls for him to run for another term as governor or for the United States Senate. But Edgar's popularity within his own party has suffered in recent years. The moderate Republican has been critical of the direction the party has shifted under President Donald Trump. And in 2024, he was one of several hundred Republicans, including fellow Illinoisans Adam Kinzinger, Ray LaHood, and Joe Walsh, who endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris under the banner of Republicans for Harris. Edgar, who supports abortion rights, has argued that Republicans need to moderate their positions on social issues if they want to compete in the Chicago suburbs, a region they must win to be competitive again in statewide elections. This had been the winning formula for him, along with other Illinois Republicans, such as Thompson and George Ryan. Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch, Democrat Hillside, who is an alum of the Edgar Fellows Program, said in a statement that Edgar is a model of a true statesman who help and many others who work in the state capitol. Governor Edgar and his family are in my prayers as they face this new challenge, Welch said. As he has worked to bring out the best in others, may our prayers and well wishes bring the best to him. Governor J.B. Pritzker, in a statement posted to his social media channels, called Edgar an honest and honorable Illinoisan and a true public servant. I know we're all rooting for and praying for him as he battles this disease, Pritzker said. Edgar grew up in Charleston, graduated from Eastern Illinois University there, and has returned often over the decades. That ongoing involvement has included being a frequent guest speaker at EIU and bringing other prominent speakers to the university, as well as recording a still-in-use introduction for the Lincoln-Douglas Debate Museum in Charleston. Consequently, Edgar's announcement on Monday sparked those who knew him through both his ties to Charleston and EIU to share some of their thoughts about him. Sad news for Illinoisans, regardless of party. A fine man and a good governor, posted Mattoon native and EIU graduate Bob Sampson, posted on his Facebook. Plus, his personal story is like a movie script, Sampson, a retired longtime communications specialist with the University of Illinois, said. He rose by extraordinary intelligence, hard work, and effectiveness at all levels. He is truly a remarkable man and deserves a biographer. Bill Lair, retired editor of the Journal Gazette and Times Courier, said Charleston and EIU were very dear to Edgar. Lair said Edgar and his wife Brenda voted in Charleston even though through his first run for governor. Lair said the morning after he won his first term as governor in November 1990, Edgar was making early morning news radio station rounds at 6:30 a.m. in Chicago. Afterwards, I was part of a small group that went to a restaurant for breakfast, Lair said. It was packed. There was a long line. The manager came and told us to follow him. He would give us the vacant table, but Edgar declined. He said we would wait our turn in line. When we finally headed to a table, the entire restaurant gave him a standing ovation. That's who Jim Edgar was. He said Edgar then came back to Charleston for a reception that night at EIU MLK Junior University Union's Grand Ballroom. Edgar's diagnosis was first reported by Politico. Now from Tony Reed in Decatur from the Macon County Courts. Move tries to save mom from prison. Defense claims Kelly Nichols did not record abuse video. In a last-ditch legal move aimed at saving a Decatur mom from prison, after she was convicted of shooting a video of child sexual abuse on her phone, defense attorneys are trying to convince a judge that new evidence shows the verdict was wrong. There is much at stake. 54-year-old Kelly Nichols is facing the prospect of spending years in prison for recording a pornographic video of a girl under the age of 13. She was convicted in Macon County Circuit Court by Judge Lindsay Shelton of 10 counts of possession of images of child sexual abuse in an October bench trial. Her husband, Douglas Nichols, 56, also was convicted of 10 counts of the same offense when they were tried together. But Kelly Nichols was then convicted of one further count on her own of making the pornographic video a Class X felony. And while the other charges leave the judge with the discretion of imposing non-custodial sentences, the video charge under law demands prison time. The defense motion trying to clear Kelly Nichols on just the video charge cites a new evidence, which it says proves the video was shot on a cell phone Nichols didn't own. It says it belonged to another family member that was not either Kelly or Douglas Nichols. Defendant Kelly Nichols moves this court to vacate its finding of guilt based on newly discovered forensic evidence that directly contradicts the court's reasoning and irrefutably establishes that Kelly Nichols did not create the video in question, said the motion. It was filed by the defense team of Andrew Wessler, Rupa Patel, and Courtney Anderson of the Decatur law firm Bolin, Robinson, and Ellis. They had previously claimed the pictures and video shot by the Nichols family were not pornographic, but just candid family snaps and images. The pictures and videos were never shown in open court, but only described. One video, for example, was of a semi-naked girl jumping up and down on a pogo stick, with the camera zooming in on her breasts. Now, in the wake of the guilty verdicts, the new motion ignores the issue of whether the video supporting the conviction is pornographic to focus on the claim Kelly Nichols never took it. As evidence, the motion quotes electronic information dug out by digital forensic expert Brian Bauman, who traced the precise history of several Apple iPhones owned by various members of the Nichols family. After listing pages of painstaking forensic digging through Apple iPhone and computer records, and citing letters from AT&T detailing phone activation dates, Bauman concludes the video recorded on January 4, 2014, was not captured on any iPhone that has been activated for defendant Kelly Nichols. The defense motion also reminds the judge that the way the video was recorded suggested Kelly Nichols was not the person shooting it. The distant sound of Kelly Nichols' voice in the background proves she did not hold the phone, it claims. Detective Eric Matthews with the Decatur Police Department, the state's primary witness, admitted that another named family member likely recorded the video. The court's ruling did not take any of this into account and concluded that it must have been Kelly taking the video on her phone. Prosecution counter-arguments have yet to be heard, and the motion will get its first airing in court on Friday when the Nichols cases are scheduled for a status hearing. Time is running out for the couple as the recent completion of sex offender evaluation reports on them clears one of the last major procedural requirements before the judge can schedule a sentencing hearing. And other complications on the whole set of other sexual offense charges faced by Douglas Nichols alone are also still to be resolved. He is pleading not guilty to 4 counts of aggravated sexual assault and 8 counts of criminal sexual abuse of a victim under the age of 18. But while the charges he shares with his wife are being handled by a special prosecutor, the charges against him are still listed as being prosecuted by Macon County State's Attorney Diane Curry. The defense team has stated previously that Curry's involvement brings up unspecified conflict of interest issues that will need to be dealt with. The history of all the sex offense cases for the Nichols couple are linked together in one way, however. It was as a result of detectives' investigation of the sex assault charges involving Douglas Nichols and digging through their family phone and computer records that they came across the images and video that led to the porn charges against both him and his wife. Now from our local and state news page, HSHS Home Care. We have a photograph of Valerie Engelbart, Supervisor for Volunteers and Bereavement Services at Hospital Sisters Health System Home Care, starting to cram the car food drive at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur on Monday. Cram the car events help to get dinner on the plate. From Donette Beckett in Decatur. The goal is to fill a Nissan Rogue SUV with non-perishable food, As full as we possibly can, Valerie Engelbart, supervisor for volunteers and bereavement services for Hospital Sisters Health System Home Care. HSHS Home Care hosted the Cram the Car food drives this week at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur and HSHS Good Shepherd Hospital in Shelbyville. Other hospitals in Illinois also have scheduled local food drives. Anything that helps our neighbors and helps get food into bellies, it's always important, said Jennifer Redman, food pantry co-director at the First United Methodist Church Food Pantry in Shelbyville. The Shelbyville Methodist Church is the recipient of the Good Shepherd Cram the Car food drive. We appreciate the generosity of everyone in our community, Redman said. Food collected at the HSHS St. Mary's Hospital parking lot will be donated to the Catholic Charities food pantry. HSHS has 9 participating hospitals in Illinois. According to Engelbart, each food drive is designated to the needs of the area and its food pantries. Our food drives for each one are tailored to that community, she said. The Shelbyville Church food pantry focuses on the basic food staples. We are just feeding our families, Redman said. Pasta and canned goods are important, but also perishable items such as ground beef, bread and fruits and vegetables, Redman added. They need to get dinner on the plate, she said about the patrons. The Litchfield location will focus on diapers and wipes. They have a really strong food program over there, Engelbart said, but they have a mom-baby program that is trying to get its legs up under it. The Greenville food drive focuses on the backpack program. So we do all kid-friendly, easy open ones, Engelbart said, about the products collected. Monetary donations are also important to the food drives. The funds are calculated to estimate the comparison of money to food weight. For every so many dollars donated, it is this many pounds of food, Engelbart said. We figure that into the total, too. The event was created nearly 10 years ago by a group of HSHS home care nurses who saw the need in many of the homes they visited. We're always trying to think of our patients when they're not our patients anymore, Engelbart said. What are they still going to need so we don't have them returning into hospitals, returning back to services? The home health care services includes home care and therapy, hospice, and palliative care. One of the concerns continued to be access to food. The convenience of things aren't necessarily the healthiest things for us, Engelbart said. Low sodium and low sugar options are not readily available, according to Engelbart. And how do you even read labels, she added. We can get you all kinds of resources and information. The food drives also gave the nurses the opportunities to hear their patients' stories. It's a great way to connect with people in our communities, Engelbart said. From Jade Aubrey, Capital News, Illinois in Springfield. Illinois residents urged to get real ID. With the deadline approaching for U.S. citizens to obtain real IDs, Illinois Secretary of State Alexei Giannoulis is urging Illinois residents to get real. Real ID is a federally standardized identification card that requires stricter proof of identity to obtain than the regular state driver's licenses or ID cards. All driver's services facilities in Illinois are issuing real IDs, except for mobile units and express facilities. Last May, Giannoulis's office launched the Get Real Illinois campaign to raise awareness about the requirements and deadline of the Real ID implementation. During a news conference this week, he continued to urge Illinoisans to obtain the new ID soon as federal deadline approaches. On May 7th, state-issued driver's licenses will no longer be accepted as a valid form of identification for domestic flights or at certain federal facilities such as military bases or federal courthouses. Although U.S. citizens will need a real ID to visit those facilities, they will not need a real ID to fly domestically if they have a valid passport. A real ID is signified by a gold star on the upper right corner of the ID card. We know for sure that as May 7th approaches, demand for real ID, driver's licenses, and state IDs will inevitably increase, Giannoulis said. What we don't want are crazy, unmanageable lines at our facilities and major issues for our individuals and their families at our airports. He said the news conference aimed to clear up confusion over the technicalities of the real ID. Since the new administration has taken over in D.C., we've seen an influx of people who are confused about what real ID means, and they think they need it as a form of identification, Giannoulias said. Our point that we're trying to hammer home today is that that's not the case. You do not need a real ID to drive a vehicle. Other qualms about the new identification have arisen, including issues around gender identity and the likelihood of the May 7th deadline holding firm. Although Giannoulias didn't directly address the first issue, he said multiple times that Illinoisans should use their own discretion to decide if the real ID is right for them. I don't want to discourage anyone from getting a real ID, but the fact is not everyone needs a real ID on May 7th, and in some cases might not ever need one, Giannoulias said. However, he did address growing skepticism that the deadline won't hold firm. I know many of you are asking yourselves after years of blown deadlines, delays, and extensions, why should we trust the Department of Homeland Security, he said. The reasons for the delays have run the gamut, ranging from partisan politics to a lack of coordination among the various federal government and states. In direct response to the terrorist attacks of 9/11, Congress passed the Real ID Act in 2005, which established minimum security standards for state-issued driver's licenses and identification cards. The effective date of the law has been extended multiple times, most recently to 2025 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now I get asked on a regular basis, is this Real ID deadline for real this time? The one thing that's different this time around is that TSA just recently published a final rule rejecting the option for another extension and requiring the regulation to finally take effect. TSA's final rule, which they published on January 13, 2025, stated the agency will begin enforcing the law on May 7th, taking what they call a phased enforcement approach to implement enforcement until May 27. Now from our opinion page, goodwill or waste? Foreign aid feeds children, fights disease, saves lives. From Diana Olbaum of the Center for International Policy, oversaw U.S. foreign aid programs for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and House Foreign Affairs Committee. She wrote this for Inside Sources. It wasn't until after Martin Niemöller, a Lutheran pastor, ended up in a Nazi concentration camp that he realized he should have done more to help Hitler's victims. He saw what was happening, but he never thought they'd come for him. Of course, they eventually did. And that's what Americans need to understand about what's happening under the Musk-Trump administration today. The attacks on refugees and immigrants, transgender people, federal workers, journalists, courts, and unions aren't one-offs. They are attacks on all of us, our Constitution, and our system of democracy. And they won't stop until people stand up and speak out. President Donald Trump isn't talking about extermination camps, but he has echoed Nazi language and imagery, and apparently has no objection to aggressive threats and campaigns of intimidation. Today, lives are at risk as a result of actions taken by Elon Musk, with Trump's blessing, that could violate federal law and constitutional principles. Cutting off all foreign assistance, even payments to U.S. businesses that have already provided goods and services under federal contracts, has meant that people with HIV and AIDS have lost access to life-saving medications. Efforts to contain the spread of deadly diseases have ground to a halt. Children have gone hungry as food goes to waste in warehouses. Under the Constitution, Congress, not the White House, holds the power of the purse. Congress specifically authorized and appropriated funds for these purposes. This is not a policy disagreement. Every administration has made its mark on foreign aid, shutting down some programs and initiating others. The problem is the administration's utter contempt for laws that protect civil and worker rights and its total disregard for constitutional checks and balances. Rules exist for reorganizing agencies and firing, reassigning and laying off federal employees. These are not being followed, according to the Washington Post. We depend on professional civil servants to ensure that essential functions of government are being carried out without political favoritism. These jobs are being handed to Trump's acolytes and cronies, according to a union lawsuit. We have ethics and conflict of interest rules to prevent graft and corruption. Musk, a major government contractor with an enormous financial stake in the outcomes, has gained direct access to U.S. government payment systems and sensitive personal data. Please stay tuned for the second half hour.